official meeting with the leader. But then leaders would realize these were just kids who had no agenda other than to be friends, and they would invite us back to their private office where we could just talk as friends. The kids would ask questions about the leaders' families, how they got into public service, and what their hopes were for the future. The leaders would talk about their children and grandchildren, what they were doing when they were our kids' age, and their dreams of friendships between people from our two countries. In one country, the kids were meeting across from the former Communist Party headquarters and were escorted past guards wearing holsters with some serious guns peeking just out of their coats. Doors were opened to a large reception room with dozens of chairs lining a huge table that must have been 50 feet long. In the room was an interpreter who greeted the kids warmly, and after a short time we heard heavy steps coming down the hallway announcing the arrival of the leader. A stout man with a grave expression entered the room, came towards us down the length of the table and sat down. There was an electrified hush in the room. The leader peered at the kids and said in Russian, "Children, I'm more nervous meeting you than if I were meeting with President Bush right now." There was a long pause as the translator finished the sentence in English. "And when I get nervous," he grumbled through his accent and paused, "I get hungry." With these words, his demeanor completely transformed. He clapped his hands and palace servants flooded into the room with trays and trays of kid food, the kind you would eat at a sleepover. Our end of the table was soon covered with strawberry tarts, pastries you could hardly see because of all the icing and cherries, unknown delights doused with whipped cream, and mountains of ice cream. The leader sat back and grinned and watched the kid's face beam with excitement. "Eat," he shouted as he raised his arms to present his feast fit for child kings. The kids tried to practice their manners, but they were appropriately swept up in the enormity of what was before them. By the time we were finished, they didn't even make a dent, to be honest. Their faces were almost totally smudged with sugar and happiness. But they got hold of themselves, wiped their faces clean with napkins that you don't throw away, and focused on the business at hand. But before they could even launch into the questions, the leader leaned towards the kids and looked furtively from side to side like he was about to tell them a secret. In a whispered voice, he said, "You know, when I was your age, my dad used to pretend that he had forgotten his hat in the woods and would send me to fetch it. Don't tell my soldiers this, but I was afraid that the bears were going to get me. So I would whistle like this." He broke into a whistled song for the children and had them whistle along. Then, with a look of a sincere friend in a heavy Russian accent, he said to the kids, "This is my promise to you. I will never let the bears get you." And with that preamble, he shared his thoughts, drenched in sincerity, about how a friend knows what you need, even before you ask. He ended his talk with these words that still ring true for our family. "You know what it is about someone that makes them a friend? A friend doesn't just say things, a friend does." At the end of each interview, the kids thanked the leader for taking the time to meet, and they handed over a small red box. Each leader carefully unwrapped their present, lifted the lid, and held up the key to our front door. The kids told each leader that they had really meant it about coming over to our house and invited them to bring their keys when they came, you know, since we were friends now. The prince loved his key, promised that he would make good use of it, and invited his new young friends to dinner at his house. This kind of invitation happened often because, even though the formal meetings were over, friendship creates a whole new economy. When people realize there's no agenda other than friendship and better understanding, it changes everything. The leaders realized we weren't there to tell them to stop doing this, start doing that, or talk about controversies or conflicting beliefs or plans. I want to live in a new normal where I can reach out to people who are different from me and just be friends. I remember hearing in elementary school that we could be pen pals with someone far away. That was great and all, but there's a big difference between being pen pals and being real pals. To make an impact, you have to go there and start a friendship. Friends do. They don't just think about it. When the kids returned from one of the trips, they read that Tun Mahathir, the Prime Minister of Malaysia and longest-serving leader in Asia, hosted the World Islamic Conference. Mahathir drew significant criticism from the international community by saying the words in his keynote address, "Death to America and death to Israel." Our State Department condemned the comments, but the kids had a better idea. They had just met with the president of Israel and wanted to share his hopes with Tun Mahathir in another in-person meeting. They sent a letter, and the next week, Mahathir's people cabled back that he would meet them just outside Kuala Lumpur the next Wednesday. It's pretty short notice to fly around the world, but we figured, what the heck? So we sold the pickup truck and we went. Because that's how love rolls. It does. Something happens when you get engaged, doesn't it? It changes everything, and the friendships made during those early days by the kids continue this day and have dramatically expanded. Why? Because they were authentic friendships. There were no angles, no plan in particular, other than to be friends. There was no agenda either. There was nothing on the other side of the equal sign to make it balance, just us. And it was all about whimsy. It was a strategic whimsy on the kids' part, one that was wise beyond its years. You'll never guess what happened a little while later. Lindsay opened up her email, and there was a short note from a leader from one of the countries. It didn't say much, just this. Dear Lindsay, we miss you and your brothers. Can we please use our key and come over for a sleepover? And they did. Chapter 11. There's More Room. I used to think I needed an invitation to get into most places, but now I know I'm already invited. My friend Brandon and I were in Washington, D.C. together, taking care of a few things. One night, we were close to Capitol Hill, and it was pretty late, almost midnight. We noticed a bunch of cars awkwardly parked around the Library of Congress. You would investigate, right? Yeah, us too. As we got closer, we saw a discreetly placed sign on the dashboard of one of the cars that was being used to barricade the library. It read, National Treasure 2. It didn't take us long to make sense of the scene, and practically in unison, we turned to each other and blurted, No way! They're filming National Treasure 2 inside the Library of Congress right now! We knew right then and there that our evening plans had changed. We were going to sneak onto the set. We ran back to where we were staying, swapped our suits for blue jeans and shirts so we could look the part of the film crew, and rushed back to the library. We had to dodge a couple of security guards, dash across a couple lawns, and cut through some bushes, but a few minutes later we found ourselves in the area where all the electrical cables and camera equipment were being unpacked. There was a side entrance for crew only, so we played the part and walked towards the door like we were supposed to be there. Nobody noticed us. People were passing us on the left and the right, but nobody suspected a thing. We just kept acting like we belonged and walked further and further into the library. At the end of each corridor, there would be a small sheet of paper taped to the wall with an arrow and the word SET printed on it. We were getting worried that this was so easy. We rounded a corner and were immediately met by a metal detector and a guard. The burst of adrenaline I felt told me we were busted. This caper was going to end poorly for sure. And I knew we would be in a lot of trouble for being in the Library of Congress in the middle of the night. Where are your crew badges? The security guard barked at us while talking to his girlfriend on the cell phone. We don't have them, we said kind of pathetically. He mumbled something to his girlfriend about guys like us on the film crew and shook his head. Irritated, he waved us through the metal detector. We moved through and sprinted down the hall while the guard was shouting something about, Badges, next time. We turned the last corner and made it onto the set. We were standing in the Library of Congress, and it was 2 o'clock in the morning. The building is massive and ornate and holds hundreds of thousands of books, millions of books, every book supposedly. I wondered how the members of Congress had time to read all of these. There was a somber silence beneath the Grand Dome, and it was hot. The movie lights were on, and having since seen the movie, I think they were filming the scene where the actors were looking for the Presidential Book of Secrets. It's a pretty cool scene. We could have powered the lights with our nervous energy, mostly because all the Capitol Police and security guards surrounding the set. It's one thing to walk onto the set like you know what you're doing, but once you get there, everyone has a job and looks busy. It's not like we could grab a camera and start filming. So after a short while, once we knew we had a great story to tell the next day, we started whispering to each other, how are we going to get out of here without getting caught? Now is when I should cue the intense movie score. Just when Brandon and I were about to turn on our heels to get out, Nicolas Cage rounded the corner in a tuxedo, along with lead actress Diane Kruger in her gown. We moved out of the way as they walked by, and without even talking, fell in behind them like we belonged to their entourage. No kidding. We walked past cast, crew, the security, as well as the Capitol Hill police. No one even asked us a question. We followed the actors right out the front door, and when they turned to the right to head towards their trailers with stars on them, we turned to the left to head towards some bushes with leaves on them. My brief cameo on the National Treasure 2 set was not my first time to D.C. The Goff family has been to the White House many times, not officially or anything, just to visit and see the nice paintings and the guys with guns under their jackets talking into their sleeves. Our visits always seemed to be around Easter because there would be this swanky Easter egg hunt happening on the lawn. We never got invited to that event, but Sweet Maria and I had a fun idea for the kids. We'd show up Easter morning and hide eggs along the black metal fence that separates those on the inside from the rest of us. We would dress up in everything to pretend like we were part of the distinguished gathering. I was always tempted to roll one of our eggs under the fence so the guys with the suits and earpieces would tackle us and then talk into their sleeves. Our little strip of grass on the sidewalk of Pennsylvania Avenue was modest in comparison to the beautifully manicured rose garden. With such a small area to work with, our eggs were super easy to spot. The kids were young enough that they really didn't notice the lack of hiding places. They just figured they were really good at finding Easter eggs, I guess. I've always wanted my kids to know they were included in important things, that they belong there, that they were invited. There's lots of things in life that you and I don't get invited to, though. I've never been invited to the Oscars or to Paul McCartney's birthday party or to a space shuttle launch. I'm waiting for my invitation to National Treasure 3. If I got an invitation to any of those things, or for that matter to the real White House Easter egg hunt, I'd definitely go. There's nothing like the feeling of being included. There's only one invitation it would kill me to refuse, yet I'm tempted to turn it down all the time. I get the invitation every morning when I wake up to actually live a life of complete engagement, a life of whimsy, a life where love does. It doesn't come in an envelope. It's ushered in by a sunrise, the sound of a bird, or the smell of coffee drifting lazily from the kitchen. It's the invitation to actually live, to fully participate in this amazing life for one more day. Nobody turns down an invitation to the White House, but I've seen plenty of people turn down an invitation to fully live. Turning down this invitation comes in lots of flavors. It looks like numbing yourself or distracting yourself or seeing something really beautiful as just normal. It can also look like refusing to forgive or not being grateful or getting wrapped around the axle with fear or envy. I think every day God sends us an invitation to live, and sometimes we forget to show up or get head faked into thinking we haven't really been invited. But you see, we have been invited, every day, all over again. There's no doubt Jesus invites us to some very cool experiences in our lives, and for that matter, in the afterlife. Jesus tells a story in the Bible about a rich guy who had a banquet. The rich guy invited lots of people, but most of them made excuses and didn't come. So the guy sent his servants to invite other folks. But this time he invited the unlikely ones, people who normally don't get invited to anything. Folks like me. The message he had for this new round of people was simple. There's more room. That was it. It wasn't a deep theological treatise, yet it was exactly that, deep and theological. I think life is like that banquet Jesus was talking about. I think God sends out his messengers to tell everyone there's plenty of room, and there's free food, and conversation, and adventure, and a wonderful and generous host who's invited us by name. It's as though the people invited to the White House Easter egg hunt didn't bother to show, and the president sends out the guys in the suits to see if anybody else wants to come. Maybe people like us, who are just on the other side of the fence. The servants come up to each of us, lean in close, and whisper in our ears, "There's more room." That's it. That's all that needs to be said. There aren't any magic words to say in response, and we don't need to give a speech or get a bracelet or a bumper sticker or a tattoo. We just need to decide to be fully engaged. Life can be like a sweepstakes, where you must be present to win. I don't think God is the kind of guy who forces himself on anyone either. If people don't want to come to his banquet, he's not bitter or anything. He loves them all the same, but he's not going to force them. Instead, he just keeps looking. He keeps saying there's more room to those who really want to be invited to where he is. He's like any of us in that way. I think God pays attention to our hearts and enjoys when people want to get close to him. He knows our sadness and our brokenness. We want to hide from him, and he sends people to look for us. When I was young and thought about God and church and Jesus, I would shy away because I thought getting close to God was like breaking onto the set of National Treasure 2. I thought there were lots of long corridors to navigate. There were arrows pointing in all kinds of directions, and the religious people were the security guards. They were the people checking to see if you had been invited. But Jesus never acted that way. When you read the Bible, the people who loved Jesus and followed him were the ones like me who don't get invited places. Yet Jesus told his friends they were invited anyway. In fact, he told them that the religious people weren't the ones who decided who got into heaven and who didn't. He said the people who followed him should think of themselves more like the ushers rather than the bouncers, and it would be God who decides who gets in. We're the ones who simply show people their seats that someone else paid for. Can you even believe that Jesus would invite people to a banquet and they wouldn't want to show up? When we accept Jesus' invitation to show up to life, we get to do life with him. And he's way more powerful and important than the president, or Nicolas Cage. A couple of other things happen when we accept Jesus' invitation to participate with him in life. Obstacles that seemed insurmountable aren't. Impediments that we believe disqualify us don't. When we show up to participate with Jesus in the big life, we're participating with the very being who made life in the first place. He gently asks us how we are and invites us to get better together with him. Accepting the invitation to show up in life is about moving from the bleachers to the field. It's moving from developing opinions to developing options. It's about having things matter to us enough that we stop just thinking about those things and actually do something about them. Simply put, Jesus is looking for us to accept the invitation to participate. It's like the president is calling us, and we just need to answer the phone. We need to show up. When we accept life's invitation, it's contagious too. Other people will watch us and start seeing life as something more amazing, more whimsical than before. When you show up to the big life, people, the type who don't think they're invited, start seeing invitations everywhere, as thick as colorful fall leaves. They don't think about their pain or their weakness any longer. Instead, they think about how incredible a big life really is and how powerful the one who is throwing the banquet is too. Jesus wants us to come. He's sending his servants out to tell the people standing at the fences and in the libraries that they're invited to the party. He's sending you an invitation too, in the sunrise, in the sound of a bird, in the smell of coffee drifting lazily from the kitchen. The one who has invited you is way more powerful than any of the impediments we think we're facing. And he has just one message for us. He leans forward and whispers quietly to each of us, "There's more room." Chapter 12. Wow, what a hit. I used to think the words spoken about us describe who we are, but now I know they shape who we are. When I was in elementary school, I played Little League baseball. I wasn't much of a sports guy. I suppose I was okay, except for the catching and throwing and hitting aspects of the game. I had a uniform, a cap, a glove, and baseball cards in the spokes of my bicycle. So the coach let me on the team and put me out in right field, where very little happens. When you're that young, nobody hits the ball to right field. I was bigger than any of the other kids on the team, so everybody assumed I could hit. The fact was, I couldn't. Because I was such a big guy, I almost covered the plate. I wasn't afraid of the ball, and the pitchers weren't very accurate, so part of our team's strategy was to send me to the plate to get beaned by a pitch or two each inning. In baseball, when you get hit, you get sent to first base, and you don't even need to swing the bat. I think baseball is the only game where all you need to do is take a ball in the face to win. My sad, sad batting average was the result of this one bad fundamental. Every time I swung the bat, I closed my eyes. It was as if my eyes and my arms were connected somehow. All season long, the only way I got onto base was by getting hit. By the end of the season, I also had 17 bone-deep bruises and a concussion. Somehow, our team got to the playoffs. I had very little to do with it, of course, apart from the bruises and a few loose teeth. Regardless, we were in. In the first playoff game, it was tied in the top of the fifth inning, and it was my turn to bat. I could hear the stands groan at the sight of the big kid who couldn't hit the ball walking up to the plate. I heard a chant starting from our own bleachers. Hit him, hit him, hit him, hoping I'd get nailed again by the pitcher and take a base. I tried to put aside the possibility that my dad might be the one leading the chant. The pitcher missed me with the first couple tosses, and suddenly I had two strikes. I wanted to end my season with a blaze of glory, so I clenched my teeth, tightened my grip, and decided to go down swinging. Feel free to read the next couple of lines in slow motion. The last pitch came soaring from the mound. I closed my eyes and swung as hard as I could. I heard this dull thwop and felt a new sensation in my hands. Somehow, miraculously, I had connected with the ball. I was so startled at first that I just stood there. Then someone on the bench shouted, "Run!" So like Forrest Gump, I ran. I galumphed around first base and watched as the ball sailed out into center field, bounced off the top of the fence, and fell over on the home run side. As I rounded third, I soaked in my glory as I stampeded towards home plate, arms raised high, making a referee's signal for a touchdown because I didn't know the difference. In the end, the other team scored about a dozen more runs in the next couple of innings, and we lost miserably. But I hardly noticed because my home run was still playing over and over in my mind, a slow-motion loop in my imagination with different camera angles and lots of old-fashioned camera bulbs flashing, people cheering or pointing upwards towards the ball or dropping their popcorn or sodas as they sprang to their feet to see what I'd just done. Everyone looked amazed, most of all me. A week or so later, I was in my room and my mom told me I had some mail. Mail? For me? I opened the big envelope and inside was a card. I think that it was the first card I'd ever received in the mail, and it was shaped like an apple. I wondered if all cards were shaped like apples. When I opened the card, the words, "You are the apple of my eye," had been printed by Hallmark inside. In handwriting, below were the words, "Wow, what a hit, Bob. You're a real ball player. Love, Coach." I reread the words over and over. "Wow, what a hit." I thought, it really wasn't that great of a hit. Did he know my eyes were closed? I read it again. "Wow, what a hit." I thought about the dozens of times I had struck out or just stepped in front of the ball, hoping my current black eye would heal before I got a new one. Then I read it again. "Wow, what a hit." What about all the times I dropped the ball or threw it into the stands by mistake? It didn't matter. "Wow, what a hit. I'm a real ball player." I read it out loud to myself. And not only that, I was the apple of his eye. I heard a self-help guy once say that you could look at the mirror and give yourself something he called positive affirmations, like saying to yourself you're good or smart or talented. I don't know if that works, to be honest. Maybe it does. But I do know one thing that works every time. It's having someone else say something good about you. I think that's how we're all created, you know, to get named by people this way. I think God speaks something meaningful into our lives, and it fills us up and helps us change the world regardless of ourselves and our shortcomings. His name for us is His Beloved. He hopes that we'll believe Him like I came to believe what the coach said about me. He hopes we'll start to see ourselves as His Beloved rather than think of all the reasons why we aren't. Sometimes we don't think the name someone picked for us is accurate either. How could the coach think of me as a real ball player? And how could God think of me as His Beloved? But then I remembered Jesus said to one of the guys with Him that he was a rock, even though he was the same guy who would deny even knowing Him. I don't think Jesus was blowing sunshine at Peter when He said that. Instead, I think He was calling something out from inside Peter. It was kind of like the coach telling me I was a real ball player. He saw it in me, and he was just calling it out. We get to do that for each other still today. It's over 40 years later, and I've watched a few baseball games, but not many. I don't have reason to think about Little League or elementary school days often, but when I do, I still think about that card from my coach. and in my mind, I can see myself pulling it out of the envelope. I can see that it's shaped like an apple, and inside, the words from a kind man, "You're the apple of my eye." Wow, what a hit, Bob. You're a real ball player. Love, Coach. Words of encouragement are like that. They have their own power, and when they're said by the right people, they can change everything. What I've found in following Jesus is that most of the time, when it comes to who says it, we each are the right people. And I've concluded something else, that the words people say to us not only have shelf life, but they have the ability to shape life. Chapter 13. Bigger and Better. I used to think I needed to sacrifice for God, but now I know faith is like a game of bigger and better. When I was a kid, we used to play a game called Bigger and Better. You probably played the same game when you were young, too. In this game, everyone starts out with something of little value, like a dime, and then everyone heads out into the neighborhood to see what they can trade for. You knock on people's doors and ask if they'd be willing to trade something for the dime, and then you go to the next door with whatever you traded for. The goal is to come back with a bigger, better thing than you started out with. The bigger it is, the better it is. My son Richard set out with a dime a while back. He went to the first door and said, "Hi, we're playing Bigger and Better. I've got a dime, and I'm hoping to trade up for something bigger. Do you have anything you'll trade me?" The guy at the door had never heard of the game. Nevertheless, he was immediately in, and he shouted over his shoulder to his wife, "Hey, Marge, there's a kid here, and we're playing Bigger and Better." I love that he said we. What do we have that's bigger and better than a dime? Richard walked away with a mattress. Rich went with his buddies to the next door, and they knocked while Rich stood on the porch with his mattress. The door opened, and his muffled voice could barely be heard as he shouted through the Serta pillow top, asking if the next neighbor would trade him for something bigger and better than a mattress. A little while later, he skipped away from the house having traded the mattress for a ping-pong table. Rich wheeled the ping-pong table to the next house and traded up for an elk head. How cool is that? I would have stopped there, but Rich didn't. He kept trading up. By the end of the night, when Rich came home, he didn't have a dime or a mattress or a ping-pong table or an elk head or the five other things he traded up for. Richard drove home in a pickup truck. No lie, he started with a dime and he ended up with a Dodge. I remember reading this quote from C.S. Lewis where he says, "It would seem that our Lord finds our desires not too strong, but too weak. We are half-hearted creatures, fooling about with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered us. Like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by an offer of a holiday at the sea. We are far too easily pleased." That quote reminds me of a story Jesus tells in the Bible about a young guy who had a lot of money. He was a pretty good guy, very religious, kept the commandments and the whole bit. Jesus told this upstanding guy that if he really wanted to know God, he needed to sell all of his possessions and follow him. The man was sad about the exchange. Like me, he liked his stuff, but he liked Jesus too. Ultimately, though, that young man decided he'd worked too hard for what he had. Whatever he had to trade to get to Jesus was just too important, and what Jesus had to offer was just too intangible. So he chose to keep his stuff rather than follow Jesus. Jesus doesn't tell that story to shame the rich young ruler. We don't even know if the rich young ruler exists, to be honest. It could just be a parable Jesus used for all of us to contemplate. The challenge that comes into sharp relief is whether we're willing to give up all that we have to follow him, to know God. Are we willing to trade up? It's a question worth asking because the answer will shape your life one way or the other. We've all given up something one time or another. At first, it always seems like a huge sacrifice to give up what we've got. To Jesus, though, it's no sacrifice at all. Think about it from his perspective. He comes from heaven, where he has an amazing love relationship with the Father, which by definition is the most beautiful existence any person can have. And he offers that to anybody willing to let go of whatever is giving them a false sense of security. Why would anyone not make that trade? Jesus is basically saying, look, none of the stuff you have is going to last, including you. You've only got about a dime's worth of life now. Come and trade up. Come follow me, and you can know God. In that sense, Jesus isn't requesting a sacrifice at all. He's asking us to play bigger and better, where we give up ourselves and we end up with him. It's important to note here that Jesus didn't ask everybody to give up all their stuff. This was something he asked of the rich young ruler because he wanted to teach the young man that he wasn't as holy as he thought he was. He wanted to teach the young man that he still needed God's help to look at what he had and decide whether he would rather have that or trade up and have what Jesus was offering, a life with him. Actually, the real game of bigger and better that Jesus is playing with us usually isn't about our money or our possessions or even our hopes. It's about our pride. He asks if we'll give up that thing we're so proud of, that thing we believe causes us to matter in the eyes of the world, and give it up to follow him. He's asking us, will you take what you think defines you, leave it behind, and let me define who you are instead? The cool thing about taking Jesus up on his offer is that whatever controls you doesn't anymore. People who used to be obsessed over becoming famous no longer care whether anybody knows their name. People who used to want power are willing to serve. People who used to chase money freely give it away. People who used to beg others for acceptance are now strong enough to give love. When we get our security from Christ, we no longer have to look for it in the world, and that's a pretty good trade. Do you know what Rich did with the truck? He gave it away. He drove it to a church down the street and tossed them the keys. He didn't need it, and he didn't want it. And what he got in exchange for it was bigger and better still. He got a sense of satisfaction, confidence, and reaffirmation that stuff didn't have control over him. While it was a good story to have traded up and gotten a truck, it was even a better story, a more whimsical one, to have given it away in the end. And he got to serve God, not by sacrificing, but by trading up in the way he lives his life. Although he started with just a dime, he walked away with a great example of how Jesus sees us in the world. Religious people say Jesus stands at the door and knocks. I agree. But there's more. Jesus invites us to stand at the door of his house and do some knocking too. And when he opens a door, he wants us to bring all the faith we have to him, even if it's just a dime's worth. And he promises that he will trade up with us, because he himself is what we have the chance to trade for. And what we'll have to give in exchange for knowing him is everything we've accumulated during our lives and are standing on the porch holding on to. Chapter 14. A New Kind of Diet. I used to think religion tasted horrible, but now I know I was just eating the fake stuff. A couple of buddies and I decided to lose a little weight this year. These are guys who will give you lots of trouble if you don't follow through. And there's no way I wanted to be the last guy dropping pounds, so I changed a few of my habits. On the first morning, I stood in front of the refrigerator with the door wide open, like my teenage boys do, as though they're watching a movie, a very cold and expensive movie. I reached for a bagel and some Philadelphia cream cheese in the familiar silver-wrapped package. This is not the breakfast choice of a love-handle-shedding champion, but I spread it a little thinner than usual and thought maybe I'd lose a few ounces anyway. Our family friend, Ashley, was staying at our house and must have bought the low-fat cream cheese this time, I thought as I cut a chunk out of the wrapper and spread it like a veneer on the bagel. I took a bite and it tasted horrible. I honestly couldn't believe anyone ate this low-fat junk. I thought, maybe if I put more of the fake cream cheese on my bagel, it might taste a little more like the real thing. So I cut a bigger chunk out of the bar and spread it on thick. I took another bite, but no difference. It actually tasted worse. I took the second half of the bagel and decided I'd go no-nonsense on it too. What the heck? If this stuff is half the calories, I can use twice as much, I reasoned. I cut another big chunk out of the cream cheese, leaving just enough so I could put it back in the refrigerator with dignity. There was no salvaging this healthy substitute. Every bite was as awful as the last. Sweet Maria came into the kitchen as I finished force-feeding myself this lackluster breakfast. Hey, I said, will you please tell Ashley not to get this low-fat junk anymore? It's horrible. Well, sure, I guess, she said with a quizzical look on her face. Then she walked over to the near-empty package, inspected it, and started belly laughing. "What?" I said, confused. In a satisfying tone, the kind that reveals in moments like this, she explained that I had just eaten nearly a whole bar of Crisco lard. Around the house, we call that being head-faked. It's a sports term, I guess, but we say it when we thought things were one way, but we got duped and it turns out that they were entirely different. Unfortunately, it happens to me in life all the time, and in faith, too. It's the stuff that masquerades as the real thing, but it's not. The perplexing thing is, instead of putting the fake stuff down, our reaction is usually to put more fake stuff on, or decide the fake stuff, while not that good, is good enough. If you ask 1,000 people who don't want anything to do with religion why that is, they'll tell you all the reasons they don't like it, but I doubt they'll be describing the real stuff. They'll describe a guy or a gal on a television show who told them if they gave money, they'd get rich. They'll talk about the big hairdo or outrageous makeup of some televangelist and the absurd things they said and did. They'll talk about someone who was religious but broke their hearts or their promise, or lied and got caught and went to jail, or who cried a lot on camera but it looked like they were faking it. Or they'll talk about someone who told them that God hated who they were, how they acted, or who they married and couldn't forgive what they'd done. It's a sad situation, honestly. The only way they can keep from being head-faked anymore is for someone to give them a taste of the real thing. And what's great is that we each have a shot at being that person. In the Bible, there's a guy named Timothy, who gets a letter from another guy named Paul. Paul's like an older brother to Timothy. In the letter, Paul tells him to watch out for people who act holy, but don't get their holiness from Jesus, but from the stuff they've done, which is pure delusion. Paul called this kind of religious devotion a form of godliness, meaning it's the exact opposite of what it's pretending to be. He was telling Timothy to watch out for people who fake it with their faith. In other words, some religion looks like it's wrapped in the right package, but it's actually Crisco. There are a couple of examples in the Bible of folks who were faking it. Jesus usually used lawyers and religious people as examples of what he didn't like. And that hits pretty close to home for me. One religious guy named Sceva had 7 sons. They were talking about Jesus, but it turned out that they were full of Crisco, and one of the bad guys they met called him on it. He said, "I know who Jesus is, and I know who Paul is, but who are you?" Like Sceva's sons, it seems like a lot of people who say they know Jesus have all the right words and all the right moves, but what they don't have is sincerity and authenticity. They talk a big game and use a bunch of 20-pound words to describe an otherwise simple idea about faith, but in reality, they never really do anything. It's like a guy with a cowboy hat, one duck, one cow, and a tractor, calling himself a rancher. We don't want to be all hat and no cattle when it comes to faith. The Bible story about Sceva's sons ends with them getting their butts kicked. Not my words, the Bible's. God doesn't like it when people fake it. It's the same as identity theft in a way, only the fakers are stealing God's identity and using it to make people feel bad or force them to change who they are to fit into some particular religious community. You can usually tell when someone is doing this because, just like Sceva's sons, they use Jesus' name a lot, but it doesn't seem that they have any of the power Jesus said would come with knowing him. That power is easy to spot because it usually comes in the form of grace and acceptance, as well as sincere love and respect. It's the kind of power that actually does things rather than just talking about them. More often than I'd like to admit, I find myself saying or doing things, calculating how it will make me sound or look to others. For example, I say that I don't have time to do something when what I really lack is compassion. Jesus is asking me and the rest of the people in the world to stop faking it. He wants us to fight the temptation to merely have the right wrapper and instead be exactly who he made us to be and who we are right where we are. None of us wants to make God look bad, but in the end, being fake makes God look worse. It makes people think he tastes like Crisco. Not only that, but when we meet people who have been fed the fake stuff about who God is and what he's about, it's not surprising that they have a little indigestion. So we can either spend our time talking about wrappers, or we can show them what God is really made of. We can show them that God is full of love and is the source of hope in every creative idea. People don't want to be told that their experiences were wrong or that their wrapper or someone else's wrapper is made of the wrong stuff. Instead, we get to be the ones to show them real love from a real God. I'm more careful about what I grab now when I go to the refrigerator. I'm a little afraid that I'll end up with another bagel full of lard, or perhaps worse. But if it does happen again, I'm not going to fake it or take another bite, and I won't put it back in the wrapper for the next person. I'm going to put it down, walk away slowly, and grab something that's better for me. Maybe an apple, although people have had problems in the past with those too. Chapter 15. By invitation only. I used to think words were all the same, but now I know there are some words I shouldn't use. Don is a friend of mine. He's written a bunch of books. It seems like just about everyone knows him, and he sold probably a million copies of his books, maybe more. He'd never tell me, and I'd feel lame asking, so I haven't. Don is one of those secretly incredible guys who doesn't talk about what he's going to do. He just does stuff. Not to direct attention to himself, but to point people towards an approachable God. Don actually played a big part in this book. He would review what I wrote and tell me to keep working on it or take it out of the book. Sometimes he'd tell me to start over entirely or tell me what to do to make it better. Don would say, "Hey, Bob, I think our writing would be better if we could," and then he'd tell me what to change. I would tease Don and tell him that I'm happy I can help this New York Times best-selling author with our writing. One day, Don said, "I shouldn't use the word that." "Really? What's wrong with the word that?" I asked. He didn't explain. He just said I wasn't supposed to use it. And he said it like he knew. He said I should treat the word that like it's a cuss word. A cuss word? Really? How come? I know a couple cuss words, and that isn't one of them. I never really got an answer to my question, and I suppose it's proper grammar to use it here and there, but not often. But none of it matters to me. All I know is Don is a great writer, and he said our writing would be better if we didn't use the word that. So now I avoid using it. I'm still not 100% sure why, but I trust Don, and that's enough. I think faith can kind of be the same way, because Jesus didn't always explain everything in great detail. If someone I trust tells me something, and I know it's for my benefit, I just trust it. I'm fine with the possibility someone might be wrong, particularly when I weigh they might be right, and my life would be better if I did what they suggest. Remember, though, I'm a lawyer. I deal with sneaky people for a living, so I'm no pushover. I've learned to sharpen my intuition about why someone offers me input. I've found one of the best filters you can use to trust someone is when there's nothing for them to gain from their advice. Here's what I mean. Many people have angles attached to their relationships. They will say or do one thing, and you learn later that they were actually angling for something else in return. We've all experienced this. A lot of Christians do the same thing with their faith without really noticing it. It's not because they're malicious or anything. They've just bought into the hype that faith is like an exclusive club you're in or something. They take what used to be authentic friendships and use them like a networking cocktail mixer. They call what the rest of us call normal acts of kindness ministry, or go on a wonderful adventure to see another country and call it a mission trip. It can come across as formulaic and manipulative to toss out some buzzwords and slip past the bouncers into the club. But these folks run the risk of downgrading a genuine and sincere faith into an infomercial for God or their own status. What I like about Jesus is that he didn't try to recruit people or use spin. Neither he nor his disciples ever said they were going on a missions trip, because they weren't. He just invited everyone and said they could follow him. He didn't use big Christian words or Christian code to cue people that he was in the club or that he wanted to protect his reputation, or talk about all the things he was going to do or the number of people he was going to have pray the prayer to accept him. He didn't present God's plan like it was a prospectus promising a return on investment. He just asked people to join the adventure. It's almost like Jesus came to say, among other things, that a relationship with him isn't supposed to make complete sense or provide security. Faith isn't an equation or a formula or a business deal that gets you what you want. In short, there's nothing on the other side of the equal sign, just Jesus. Jesus didn't give people a lot of directions about what they should or shouldn't say either, but he did talk quite a bit about their hearts. He said their hearts would be better if they stayed away from certain things. It was kind of like he told them not to write the word that into their lives. Not because he was trying to control their lives, but because he wanted them to write their lives better, I suppose. I trust Don because he's a good author. I trust God because he's the best author. I think God doesn't spell out everything for us in life, but he does tell us how we can write our lives better, and trusting him implicitly is always the right place to start. My favorite book isn't War and Peace or Huckleberry Finn, although Huckleberry Finn is close. It's a thesaurus. The reason is simple. There are hundreds of words, probably thousands of them listed that can capture an idea or thought and propose words to describe those thoughts or ideas with greater precision, which would add much more clarity to what I'm trying to say. Now I try to explain my faith in much the same way a thesaurus does and see if I can't swap a word that is used far too much for another that might add more meaning, more life. I still don't know why Don told me not to write the word that, but I'd like to think it has something to do with how he wants me to stretch for a better, clearer way to express myself than I have in the past. I think God maybe feels the same way. Chapter 16. Hunting Grizzlies. I used to think I had missed the mark and God was mad about it, but now I know missing the mark is a stupid analogy. When I was a kid, I had a great relationship with my dad, and my dad loved guns. My sister and I didn't get along that well. She was bigger than I was and beat me up, so I would mostly hang out with my mom and dad. Back then, my dad either spent his time gardening or doing something that revolved around hunting. He had a huge rifle and treated it like a classic car, rubbing it with oils and soft cloths. When my dad was done pampering the rifle, he would let me hold it and we'd pretend I was out on the trail of a grizzly bear. I was about 8 years old and hadn't actually seen a grizzly bear, but I could imagine it perfectly in my mind, hiding behind the couch or under the dining room table. My dad patiently taught me how to handle and shoot a rifle. He taught me a healthy respect for guns, about how dangerous they were, and how carefully they had to be treated. I was his young apprentice. Son, you need to look through the scope at the things that are far away, but you also need to take your eye away long enough to see what's close. The life lessons in that statement escaped me at the time, but I've come back to words of wisdom like this when I had to pull the trigger on a trial or a business deal, or a caper of some sort. Then, he would pause with the seriousness of a monk, it's all about how you pull the trigger. He was almost at a whisper as he continued, if you pull hard, it will jerk the gun off target, so you need to pull the trigger super slow. I stared back at him, my eyes glued to his. Got it, Dad, super slow. What you do is this. He leaned forward and wrapped his arms around mine while I held the rifle. You take a full breath, he breathed in deeply. You let half of it out, then slowly squeeze the trigger. He almost chanted it like it was a poem. Take a full breath, let half of it out, then slowly squeeze the trigger. He repeated it over and over, so I did too. I didn't want to forget, not with grizzlies loose in the house. My mom was not enthusiastic about guns, but my dad insisted they were safe when treated with respect. He would also go off on tangents about how guns were mentioned in the Constitution. And the way I remember it, it was our responsibility as Americans to own them. And Americans were supposed to train their children to use guns so they could shoot the British if they try the invasion thing again. So, against her better judgment, my mom let Dad keep a couple guns in the house. My dad was so serious about guns, he even made his own ammo. Not the ammo like in the Revolutionary War, like musket balls, but actual modern-looking, pointier ammo you would shoot a grizzly bear with. The polished brass shell casings might as well have been gold coins in his hand, and my dad would sit in a chair by the window, filling the casings with gunpowder he pulled from a small bag at his feet. Don't get the impression that we lived on Ruby Ridge or were survivalists or anything. My dad simply loved making ammo, like some people love making bread. After a long and loving process, in order to make sure the bullet wouldn't jam in the rifle, my dad would run the shell through the gun. During all of this, he kept his rifle leaning against the table, and after running a bullet through, he would tuck it into a box with the others. They stood like a row of soldiers, ready to take the field. My favorite part about my dad's rifle was the big, dark, telescopic scope. The scope was huge, manly. It looked like it came right out of a sniper movie. And it even had crosshairs. Guys like anything with crosshairs. That's why guys don't watch romantic movies, because there aren't any crosshairs. If they released a Pride and Prejudice with crosshairs over some of the characters, guys would line up for days to take their girlfriends. One day, when I got a little older, my dad was making his bullets, and I asked if I could hunt the grizzly. He considered my request quietly and thoughtfully. Then he checked the chamber to make sure it wasn't carrying any live ammunition. He leaned it in my direction, and I gripped it slowly, like I was being sworn into the Secret Service. I lifted it off the ground, swung it around carefully, and put my eye against the scope, looking through the crosshairs for the grizzly. We needed a new rug in front of the fireplace, and this might be our chance. Looking through the scope, I was no longer standing in the den with my dad. I was crouched in a dark forest, dressed in full camouflage, waiting for the grizzly to walk through the room. And then it did. With the glass of the scope against my eye, I silently recited the words my dad had taught me. I took a full breath, let half of it out, and then I slowly squeezed the trigger. Turns out there was a bullet in the gun. The violent sound that ripped through our house sounded like a cannon blast. The bullet cut through the air at 1,800 feet per second, drilling its way through the sheetrock and boring through bracing studs like butter. It buzzed through the hallway and into the next room, where it lodged itself just above my sister's bed. Because of the way I was holding the rifle, with a stock tucked under my arm and scope firmly against my eye, I took the full recoil around my right eye. After a couple of minutes, I came to and noticed my favorite t-shirt was drenched in blood. My first thought was that I had done something wrong and I was going to get spanked. My second thought was about whether I got the grizzly. A neighborhood boy had been over playing and ran outside to tell all the neighbors I'd just shot myself in the head. My sister ran in the house to ask if she could have my bike. Through my bloody eye, I could see my dad standing over me, distraught but determined. He scooped me up into his arms and got blood all over his shirt. He carried me away to the hospital and the doctor stitched me up. I was sent home black and blue, but looking very manly. My sister gave me a disappointed look when she realized I was still alive and she wouldn't be getting my bike. I walked into her room, stared at the bullet hole, and calculated the distance between it and her pillow. "Just down and to the right," I said. She never picked on me again after that. I tell you this story because much later I'd meet some Christians who used gun analogies about targets and missing the mark and all of that. Or maybe it was about archery. Nevertheless, this analogy would be dragged out to tell us we were all blowing it and falling short. They also talked about how God was really mad at certain people because of what they believed or about the things they'd done. These Christians sounded a little judgmental, to be honest. Looking back, though, these folks seemed dead set on pulling the trigger more than anyone else I'd ever met. They would find anyone who messed up or made a bad decision, and they'd get them in their sights. I didn't like that, because I messed up a lot, and there's something creepy about feeling like you're in someone's crosshairs. Maybe it's one of those times where, like my dad said, these folks needed to take their eyes away from the scope for a while in order to see what's close, like their own hurts and mistakes. I think we all need to do that from time to time. I sure do. As I've gotten older, I've come to learn most people aren't bad in the traditional sense. I mean, they aren't malicious or plotting a bank robbery or setting up scams. The people I know, they're mostly aiming their crosshairs at stuff like being loved, not being lonely, finding some security, and a bunch of other things that are actually pretty normal and worth pursuing. In fact, I think God put it in our hearts to aim for those things, and it's nice when we actually hit those targets. Sometimes, though, things can go horribly wrong, and we end up flat on our backs in a blood-soaked t-shirt. I don't think God is mad at us when that happens. He knew when he made the world that there was going to be some pain and people were going to get hurt, whether they did it to themselves or others did it to them. He knew people were going to manipulate each other and cheat and try to love and respect in inappropriate ways. Still, it's hard for me to see him enjoying the pain when we fail. These days, the view of God I hold on to isn't him being mad because I've missed the mark. It's the one of him, seen through a bloody eye, scooping me up into his arms, getting blood all over his shirt, and carrying me away to get healed. Chapter 17. Corner Store Economics. I used to think rules were made by someone else, but now I know we get to make some of our own. When I was a kid, I used to walk to the corner store to buy candy. The store in our town had a bell on a spring that would jingle whenever the door opened. Inside was a wonderful old man at the register who was covered in gray hair and looked like the guy in the movie Up. He had white whiskers that poked out of his face like small corn stalks, and whenever someone entered and the bell rang, he'd stop bagging groceries to offer a grin and a nod. In my young mind, he was the candy keeper, the luckiest man in the whole world. I reasoned that any time he wanted, he could